This is May 18th, 2008, and today I'm going to explore issues of virtue and integrity in connection with the green effort that's gaining so much steam. And I'll be reading from another article by Michael Pollan. And this is from the New York Times from a month ago, April 20th. And the name of the article is Why Bother? Michael Pollan, I read from one of his books recently, a book called The Botany of Desire. I entitled that Teisho, Memory, Marijuana, and Zen. Here's a very different topic. And he starts off, why bother? That really is the big question facing us as individuals hoping to do something about climate change, and it's not an easy one to answer. I don't know about you, but for me, the most upsetting moment in An Inconvenient Truth came long after Al Gore scared the hell out of me, constructing an utterly convincing case that the very survival of life on Earth as we know it is threatened by climate change. No, the really dark moment came during the closing credits when we are asked to change our light bulbs. That's when it got really depressing. The immense disproportion between the magnitude of the problem Gore had described and the puniness of what he was asking us to do about it was enough to sink your heart. But the drop in the buck bucket issue is not the only problem lurking behind the why bother question. Let's say I do bother, big time. I turn my life upside down. Start biking to work, plant a big garden, turn down the thermostat so low I need the Jimmy Carter signature cardigan, forsake the clothes dryer for a laundry line across the yard, trade in the station wagon for a hybrid, get off the beef, go completely local. I have to pause here and put in a plug for vegetarianism. I've read from two sources that the greenhouse gas emissions generated by the livestock industry through methane and nitrous oxide, they're all byproducts of the livestock industry, those greenhouse gas emissions are more than all forms of transportation combined. Flying, driving, everything combined does not add up to as much as those greenhouse gas sources don't add up to those from the meat industry. And this is why the Union of Concerned Scientists has said that the number one thing an individual can do to combat global warming is to adopt a vegetarian diet. But to continue here, I could theoretically do all that, but what would be the point when I know full well that halfway around the world, there lies my evil twin, some carbon footprint doppelganger in Shanghai or Chongqing, who has just bought his first car, is eager to swallow every bite of meat, I forswear, and who's positively itching to replace every last pound of CO2 I'm struggling no longer to emit. So what exactly would I have to show for all my trouble? Well, just to address this issue, obviously, no matter how many other people are contributing to the global carbon footprint, elsewhere in the world, we do what we can because every little bit helps. But there's a more fundamental reason to do everything we can, regardless of what those in China or India or anywhere else might be doing. And it's because it's a matter of integrity. We do this. We strive to find ways not to contribute to global warming, pollution, because that's just, again, a matter of integrity. I looked up the word integrity, and two of the definitions I think are particularly good here. One is the quality or state of being complete, unbroken condition, wholeness, entirety. The truth is that the world is not fragmented. There aren't, you know, billions of separate selves going about their businesses in this world. There is just this one self, capital S. As Hakuin said, I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth. This is what enlightenment reveals, that we are all, as we say in Zen, all of one mind. And so long as we are thinking about the Chinese or the Indians or our next-door neighbors or people in another city, then we are separated. We are perpetuating the illusion of separation. We do things because they don't cause harm, because they contribute to a less painful world. We do things for our own sake. There's a story that Roshi Kapil used to tell about, this is from a Japanese temple where the American visiting there would conscientiously get up each morning following the temple schedule. He'd get up and go to the zendo, and he found that he was the only one there. And I've heard of this in Japan, where there's the Japanese are famous for having a front and a back to everything. There's the schedule that's official, and then there's, it may or may not be followed. Well, this foreigner would endeavor to follow the schedule. He'd get up in the morning and find that there was no one else there. And it happened a couple times, three times, and he finally went to the abbot, and he said, "What's going on here? Why should I come to the morning sitting when no one else does?" And the abbot said, "For whom do you sit?" Actually, excuse me. I think the issue was getting up and sweeping the temple. It doesn't matter. It's the same principle, but it was sweeping the temple. And the abbot said, "For whom do you clean the temple? Do it for yourself. Always. That's where we can make a difference in terms of our own mind, our own development. We don't have to worry about others in this regard. If we're living in integrity and taking responsibility for this one person. Goethe once said, "I have come to the frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element. It is my personal approach that creates the climate. It is my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis is escalated or de-escalated, and a person is humanized or dehumanized. If we treat people as they are, we make them worse. If we treat people as they ought to be, we help them become what they are capable of becoming. Well, a Buddhist version of that is if we treat people as they often act, as we all often act, then we can make things worse. But if we treat people as they are in their essential nature, then we help them become what they are capable of becoming. So, yeah, I'll continue here. He goes on, a sense of personal virtue, you might suggest, somewhat, this is the last sentence of the previous paragraph. So what exactly would I have to show for all my trouble? And he answers rhetorically, a sense of personal virtue, you might suggest, somewhat sheepishly. But what good is that when virtue itself is quickly becoming a term of derision? And not just on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal or on the lips of the vice president, who famously dismissed energy conservation as a sign of personal virtue. No, even in the pages of the New York Times and the New Yorker, it seems the epithet virtuous, when applied to an act of personal environmental responsibility, may be used only ironically. This, I think, is pretty clear that this is just an attempt by people who disparage virtue, whether it's in terms of environmental awareness or something else, as coming out of their own sense of guilt and wanting to diminish others who are trying to do something about it. Tell me, how did it come to pass that virtue, a quality that for most of history has generally been deemed, well, a virtue, became a mark of liberal soft-headedness? How peculiar that doing the right thing by the environment, buying the hybrid, eating like a locavore, should now set you up for the Ed Begley Jr. treatment. Whoever that is. I went and also looked up virtue because it's a really rich word. My immediate association was with this question that tormented the great Japanese Zen master Bankei. When he was a very young man, he heard in one of his Confucian classes of Confucian text, and one of the four books, the four great books of Confucianism, the teacher came to these words, the way of great learning lies in clarifying bright virtue. Bankei interrupted the teacher. What is bright virtue? He asked. The teacher, repeating the glosses given in one of the traditional commentaries, answered, the intrinsic nature of good in each person. Bankei asked what the intrinsic nature of man was and was told, it's his fundamental nature. Then what is that? Bankei persisted. The ultimate truth of heaven, replied the teacher. None of these answers satisfied Bankei. And then this initiated a period of years where the young Bankei struggled with this question, what is bright virtue? This became a real basic life koan for him, natural koan for him. It's not that the teacher's answers were wrong, but answers don't satisfy true spiritual questions. One of the definitions that I found for virtue, this is in a Webster's dictionary, is the fifth definition. It defines virtue as effective power or force, efficacy, potency, especially the ability to heal or strengthen. So it's, from a Zen perspective too, it's not just a matter of right and wrong or good and bad. These terms don't begin to get at the bright virtue that Bankei was struggling with. What is this bright virtue? What is true virtue with a capital V? Virtue that existed before we divided the world into good and bad, between virtuous and unvirtuous, to tap into that mind is to be empowered, to have force, to have the ability to heal or strengthen. And this is, I believe, fundamentally the most we can do in struggling with global warming or any other ethical matter, is to reach beyond notions to the source of all such notions, to see into this mind that out of which comes all such divisions. In other words, Zazen, daily Zazen, as the ground of ethical action, the ground of power in changing the world, starts with changing oneself, because the world is not separate from oneself. These are just divisions that we came up with, that we learned as children, when we learn language. There's self and other. There's me and there's the world. It's not that there is no usefulness to such distinctions. That's why we use words, the personal pronouns, and words like self and other. But there is a realm, a reality beyond that, beneath that. And that's the wellspring of all good actions. Yasutani Roshi once said, "One's environment or circumstances of one's life are a reflection of one's mind. It's like an echo which reverberates according to the sound of our voice. Instead of trying to change our environment when we are unhappy, we need to change ourselves, since our environment is the reflection of ourselves. There is nothing beyond one's consciousness. To think otherwise is to live in a dream world." When he says, instead of trying to change our environment, I would say that what he really means is, instead of setting that as our fundamental goal, to apply ourselves to serious daily practice, will find us also trying to change the environment. Because ultimately, we come to see through Zazen, a life grounded in Zazen, we come to see that the environment is nothing out there. There is no out there, out there. That Each one of us is the environment. This is the fundamental point. This is the great contribution that the Buddhist tradition makes to this matter of environmental action, is to see that there is no such thing as an environment out there separate from the self here. There's nothing beyond one's consciousness. The Buddha put it very famously, "Verily, I declare unto you that within this very body, mortal though it be, and only a fathom high, but conscious and endowed with mind, is the rising of the world, and the waxing thereof, and the waning thereof, and the way that leads to the passing away thereof." It's all right here. It's all within our hands and our legs, our crossed legs, or our walking legs. He goes on, "And even if in the face of this derision I decide I am going to bother, there arises the whole vexed question of getting it right. Is eating local or walking to work really going to reduce my carbon footprint? According to one analysis, if walking to work increases your appetite and you consume more meat or milk as a result, walking might actually emit more carbon than driving. A handful of studies have recently suggested that in certain cases, under certain conditions, produce from places as far away as New Zealand might account for less carbon than comparable domestic products. True, at least one of these studies was co-written by a representative of agribusiness interests in, surprise, New Zealand. But even so, they make you wonder. If determining the carbon footprint of food is really this complicated, and I've got to consider not only food miles, but also whether the food came by ship or truck and how lushly the grass grows in New Zealand, then maybe on second thought I'll just buy the imported chops at Costco, at least until the experts get their footprints sorted out." This is, he's putting his finger on one of the real crippling hazards of paying attention to all this, is that we can get so confused and exasperated by the complexity of it that we just rationalize ignoring the whole thing and just going about our business as usual. But it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We don't have to devote hours a day of analyzing all of this and trying to come up with the right thing. Sit. And I firmly believe that these things sort themselves out over time, and we become less obsessed with right and wrong, and we just can find our way back to what we can do. And that may change. We may do something like walking to work for a while and then find that it doesn't work for one reason or another, and we try something else. But don't just abandon the whole thing because it's so complicated. It's really much of this article and this whole topic is really kind of an analog for practice. When we're sitting and we find that we're complicating things so much with our minds, and we're getting into this and that, and we're watching ourselves, and there too, there is the temptation to just get frustrated by the whole thing and the seeming complexity of it, and wanting to let go of it. But we have to just stay with it. And certainly in the case of Zazen, it does get more simple. Things clarify. As thoughts settle, things clarify. Why would that be any different with trying to find ways of changing behavior to leave less of a global footprint? Zazen is just kind of a laboratory of how we respond to change and what we can do. This dance between effort and surrender, between doing and non-doing. Wu Wei, as they have it in China. The worst thing is to lose heart, whether it's Zen practice or in addressing these matters of how our personal lifestyles affect the larger world. He goes on, there are so many stories we can tell ourselves to justify doing nothing, but perhaps the most insidious is that whatever we do manage to do, it will be too little, too late. Climate change is upon us, and it has arrived well ahead of schedule. Scientists' projections that seemed dire a decade ago turn out to have been unduly optimistic. The warming and the melting is occurring much faster than the models predicted. Now, truly terrifying feedback loops threaten to boost the rate of change exponentially, as the shift from white ice to blue water in the Arctic absorbs more sunlight and warming soils everywhere become more biologically active, causing them to release their vast stores of carbon into the air. Have you looked into the eyes of a climate scientist recently? They look really scared. So do you still want to talk about planting gardens? I do. Whatever we can do as individuals to change the way we live at this suddenly very late date does seem utterly inadequate to the challenge. It's hard to argue with Michael Spector in a recent New Yorker piece on carbon footprints when he says, personal choices, no matter how virtuous, there's that word again, cannot do enough. It will also take laws and money. That's the end of the quote. And then Pollan says, so it will. Yet, it is no less accurate or hard-headed to say that laws and money cannot do enough either, that it will also take profound changes in the way we live. Why? Because the climate change crisis is at its very bottom a crisis of lifestyle, of character even. The big problem, capital B, capital P, is nothing more or less than the sum total of countless little everyday choices, most of them made by us. Consumer spending represents 70% of our economy, and most of the rest of them made in the name of our needs and desires and preferences. For us to wait for legislation or technology to solve the problem of how we're living our lives suggests we're not really serious about changing, something our politicians cannot fail to notice. They will not move until we do. Indeed, to look to leaders and experts, to laws and money and grand schemes, to save us from our predicament, represents precisely the sort of thinking, passive, delegated, dependent for solutions on specialists, that helped get us into this mess in the first place. It's hard to believe that the same sort of thinking could now get us out of it. So again, he insists that it comes down to oneself. We can't mandate what others can do or should do. That's not our business in Zen practice, is to think in terms of shoulds and oughts. We have the freedom at every moment, the freedom of choice. What choices are we making? They count. Less, we need to dwell less on others, other countries, other people, and pay more attention to our own choices. It's not either or. It's not, well, we have to decide between what my daily life and my choices. It's that or laws and money. No. He goes on, 30 years ago, Wendell Berry, the Kentucky farmer and writer, put forward a blunt analysis of precisely this mentality. He argued that the environmental crisis of the 1970s, an era innocent of climate change, what we would give to have that environmental crisis back, was at its heart a crisis of character and would have to be addressed first at that level, at home, as it were. He was impatient with people who wrote checks to environmental organizations while thoughtlessly squandering fossil fuel in their everyday lives. The 1970s equivalent of people buying carbon offsets to atone for their Tahoes and Durangos. Again, here, just to interject, of course, there's nothing wrong with writing checks to effective environmental organizations. It's just that if we do only that and ignore our personal impact, our individual choices, that's what Berry is decrying. And then Pollan says, nothing was likely to change until we healed the, and then he's quoting Berry, the split between what we think and what we do. The split between what we think and what we do, there lies the problem. I think of this famous passage by T.S. Eliot, who is very Buddhistic in his writing, where he said, between the idea and the reality, between motion and the act falls the shadow. Between conception and creation, between emotion and response falls the shadow. Our work in this way, this Dharma, is to heal this split, this cleavage. Strictly speaking, we don't have to heal anything. There is no split. It's all in our minds. But you could say that awakening to that fact that there never has been any split and living in accordance, living out of that integrity is the healing. Recognizing that this world of thoughts and reading, these two are very, very similar, thoughts and reading, they're both passive, that world is a somewhat unreal one if it's not marshaled, what we learn or come to understand through our thoughts and reading, to use that to respond to suffering and the looming crisis of global warming. This is what we're doing in Zazen. This is the fundamental work of Zen. And we see it right in our sitting, where we have this split to one degree or another. Most of us, most of the time, are split. There's the sitting, the simple stillness of sitting, and then there's the thought activity going on, and our attending to the thought activity and getting and pursuing thoughts. There's the split. We see it in practice in the wider sense of active practice, where almost everything we do in our waking hours, almost everything we do simultaneously, our mind is somewhere else. There's the split. There's the shadow. So we sit not just as a means to an end, but to manifest the fundamental non-division of mind and reality. To enter this true empty world, immediately affirm not to. In this not to, all is the same, with nothing separate or outside. It is only our thoughts that cause us to believe in separation. When there are no thoughts, the mind is absolutely empty, then there is just this one mind, this one web of interconnection. And that's what will inspire us and galvanize us to make some sacrifices and some changes in our lifestyles. Nothing was likely to change until we healed the split between what we think and what we do. He goes on, for Barry, the why bother question came down to a moral imperative. And then he quotes Barry again. Once our personal connection to what is wrong becomes clear, then we have to choose. We can go on as before, recognizing our dishonesty and living with it the best we can, or we can begin the effort to change the way we think and live. So when, each one of us can ask, when are we going to do this? There's a passage I read while I was in Cleveland this winter, and unfortunately, I don't know who wrote this, but I just love it. And it's about happiness and finding happiness. You could also say it's about integrity, finding integrity, eliminating the shadow, the separation between what we know is right and the way we live our lives. It could also be a matter of simply practice itself, sitting, sashin. Here's what this person said. We convince ourselves that life will be better after we get married, have a baby, then another. Then we are frustrated that the kids aren't old enough and will be more content when they are. After that, we're frustrated that we have teenagers to deal with. We will certainly be happy when they are out of that stage. We tell ourselves that our life will be complete when our spouse gets his or her act together, when we get a nicer car, are able to go on a nice vacation, when we retire. The truth is, there's no better time to be happy than right now. We could say to practice than right now. And practice doesn't mean just sitting, remember. Means attending, being fully engaged with everything we do. He goes on, if not now, when? Your life will always be filled with challenges. It's best to admit this to yourself and decide to be happy anyway. Actually, it's happiness and zazen are a big overlap between the two. He goes on, for a long time it had seemed to me that life was about to begin, real life. But there was always some obstacle in the way, something to be gotten through first, some unfinished business, time still to be served, a debt to be paid. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Then life would begin. At last it dawned on me that these obstacles were my life, were my practice. So stop waiting until you finish high school, until you go back to school, until you lose 10 pounds, until you gain 10 pounds, until you have kids, until your kids leave the house, until you start work, until you retire, until you get married, until you get divorced, until Friday night, until Sunday morning, until you get a new car or home, until your car or home is paid off, until spring, until summer, until fall, until winter, until you're off welfare, until the 1st or 15th, until your song comes on, until you've had drink, until you've sobered up, until you die, until you are born again to decide that there is no better time than now to be happy, to practice. Happiness, he says, is a journey, not a destination. Practice is a process. It's not some place out there that we can wait for, that we need to wait for. Back to the Pollan article. For Barry, the deep problem standing behind all the other problems of industrial civilization is specialization, which he regards as the disease of the modern character. Our society assigns us a tiny number of roles. We're producers of one thing at work, consumers of a great many other things the rest of the time, and then once a year or so we vote as citizens. Virtually all of our needs and desires we delegate to specialists of one kind or another. Our meals to agribusiness, health to the doctor, education to the teacher, entertainment to the media, care for the environment to the environmentalist, political action to the politician. He's really onto something here, isn't he? We could say, I can't help but thinking of this big phenomenon now Eckhart Tolle, where he's drawing these massive, massive crowds of people by talking about his awakening, which seems genuine enough. But you see how people abdicate responsibility for their own spiritual practice by those who just go to these talks or just read the books. That's so simple. It's so easy to do that. But there are millions of people who just leave it at that. They read the books, they swoon over his message, they go maybe to one of his talks, and they savor the spiritually perfumed atmosphere of these places, and then that's it. That's the danger of any teacher, whether it's Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie or Thich Nhat Hanh, who draws these kinds of, this has this popular appeal that people will just crowd into the movement without doing the work. And that's all the easier to do this, not do the work when there is no method or serious training or practice that is emphasized. He goes on, as Adam Smith and many others have pointed out, this division of labor has given us many of the blessings of civilization. Yet this same division of labor obscures the lines of connection and responsibility, linking our everyday acts to their real life, their real world consequences, making it easy for me to overlook the coal-fired power plant that is lighting my computer screen, or the mountaintop in Kentucky that had to be destroyed to provide the coal to that plant, or the streams running crimson with heavy metals as a result. Of course, what made this sort of specialization possible in the first place was cheap energy. Cheap fossil fuel allows us to pay distant others to process our food for us, to entertain us, and to try to solve our problems, with the result that there is very little we know how to accomplish for ourselves. Think for a moment of all the things you suddenly need to do for yourself when the power goes out, up to and including entertaining yourself. Think, too, about how a power failure causes your neighbors, your community, to suddenly loom so much larger in your life. Cheap energy allowed us to leapfrog community by making it possible to sell our specialty over great distances, as well as summon into our lives the specialties of countless distant others. Here's the point. Cheap energy, which gives us climate change, fosters precisely the mentality that makes dealing with climate change in our own lives seem impossibly difficult. Specialists ourselves, we can no longer imagine anyone but an expert or anything but a new technology or law solving our problems. Al Gore asks us to change the light bulbs because he probably can't imagine us doing anything much more challenging, like, say, growing some portion of our own food. We can't imagine it either, which is probably why we prefer to cross our fingers and talk about the promise of ethanol and nuclear power, new liquids and electrons to power the same old cars and houses and lives. The cheap energy mind, as Wendell Berry called it, is the mind that asks, why bother? Because it is helpless to imagine, much less attempt, a different sort of life, one less divided, less reliant. Since the cheap energy mind translates everything into money, its proxy, it prefers to put its faith in market-based solutions, carbon taxes, and pollution trading schemes. If we could just get the incentives right, it believes, the economy will properly value everything that matters and nudge our self-interest down the proper channels. The best we can hope for is a greener version of the old invisible hand. Visible hands it has no use for. But while some such grand scheme may well be necessary, it's doubtful that it will be sufficient or that it will be politically sustainable before we've demonstrated to ourselves that change is possible. Merely to give, to spend, even to vote, is not to do, and there is so much that needs to be done without further delay. Which brings us back to the why bother question and how we might better answer it. The reasons not to bother are many and compelling, at least to the cheap energy mind. But let me offer a few admittedly tentative reasons that we might put on the other side of the scale. If you do bother, you will set an example for other people. This, by the way, we can also apply to sitting. If enough other people bother, each one influencing yet another in a chain reaction of behavioral change, markets for all manner of green products and alternative technologies will prosper and expand. Just look at the market for hybrid cars. Consciousness will be raised, perhaps even changed. New moral imperatives and new taboos might take root in the culture. Driving an SUV or eating a 24-ounce steak or illuminating your McMansion like an airport runway at night might come to be regarded as outrages to human conscience. Not having things might become cooler than having them. And those who did change the way they live would acquire the moral standing to demand changes in behavior from others, from other people, other corporations, even other countries. All of this could theoretically happen. What I'm describing, imagining would probably be more accurate, is a process of viral social change. And change of this kind, which is non-linear, is never something anyone can plan or predict or count on. Who knows, maybe the virus will reach all the way to Chongqing and infect my Chinese evil twin. Or not. Maybe going green will prove a passing fad and will lose steam after a few years, just as it did in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan took down Jimmy Carter's solar panels from the roof of the White House. Going personally green is a bet, nothing more or less, though it's one we probably all should make, even if the odds of it paying off aren't great. Sometimes you have to act as if acting will make a difference, even when you can't prove that it will. That's a good one there. And that also applies to sitting. Practice in general. Sometimes you have to act as if acting will make a difference, even when you can't prove that it will. This is the fundamental problem with accepting the power we have, the fundamental power we have of of changing the world as we change ourselves, is that it can't be empirically proven. We can't empirically prove that this true self is no self, that this, what we call self, is the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth, as Hakuin said. Awakening reveals that it is. And once we have that experience, there's no excuse, is there, for pretending that it's just me. I'm just one person. What can I do? Not two. Sometimes you act as if acting will make a difference even when you can't prove that it will. That, after all, was precisely what happened in communist Czechoslovakia and Poland when a handful of individuals like Václav Havel and Adam Michnik resolved that they would simply conduct their lives as if they lived in a free society. That improbable bet created a tiny space of liberty that in time expanded to take in and then help take down the whole of the Eastern Bloc. So what would be a comparable bet that the individual might make in the case of the environmental crisis? Havel himself has suggested that people begin to, quote, conduct themselves as if they were to live on this earth forever and be answerable for its condition one day. Fair enough, but let me propose a slightly less abstract and daunting wager. The idea is to find one thing to do in your life that doesn't involve spending or voting, that may or may not virally rock the world, but is real and particular. And that, come what may, will offer its own rewards. Maybe you decide to give up meat, an act that would reduce your carbon footprint by as much as a quarter. Or you could try this, determine to observe the Sabbath. For one day a week, abstain completely from economic activity. No shopping, no driving, no electronics. And then, we're out of time now, but then he goes on to say that the act I want to talk about is growing some, even just a little, of your own food. Rip out your lawn if you have one. And so forth. I have to skip over that because our time is about up. I have to say that I, for years now, I've felt badly that here at the center at Chapin Mill, we don't use some of our garden space more. We don't plant and harvest our own vegetables. I don't see how we could do that now. Staff is spread so thin. I don't see how we can do it now. We'll keep looking for opportunities. What we concentrate on instead is not wasting things and finding this very difficult balance between the cost of organic foods and things like that and the importance of it. We always have to consider the cost to the center, which means the Sangha, of these more pure ways of living, like through our organic foods. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.